You're a native New Yorker, aren't you?
I know, I'm from Jersey City.
Well, I can...
Practically.
Yeah, I was going to say, I could. Yeah. You still have the northeastern sound to your voice.
Oh, yes, definitely. Well, the Jersey City accent is what I put it more crudely.
Well, there's
do have one. We do have such a phenomenon, you know. I can almost tell if I meet somebody from Jersey City that he's from, you know, I recognize the accent.
From New Jersey rather than New York? I mean, how do you tell, really? New Jersey,
well,
New York?
There's a slight, that we don't tend to pronounce our R's as much in New Jersey, particularly in Jersey City and Hudson County. We say paper. I remember once I was in Chicago when I was only in college, and these guys sat around making me pronounce words for about 3 hours, and every one I pronounced, they all lie on the floor and scream and laugh. I mean, I never realized I was so amusing, you know, but it was all just a certain way I pronounced these things, particularly skipping certain letters like R's, you know.
Where does Thomas Kane get that accent? That's not New Jersey.
No, well, that's an upper class. that's a Groton accent, basically, I think. Yeah, Groton, Kennedy-esque, you know.
New Jersey.
Yeah, New Jersey. Yeah, well, there is a slight, you know, alteration from the New Jersey side, too, but it's really, that's an upper class accent, you know. My father was a ward leader.
He didn't go to jail, did he?
No, he managed to stay out of jail.
One of the clean ones.
That was a phenomenon. Well, I wouldn't say that either. He was smart, though.
I guess that crooked politics. I'm not saying your father was involved in it, obviously.
Well, he was.
Oh, God.
He was one of Frank Haig's right-hand men.
No kidding.
In Jersey City, yes. That's where I like to say that's where I first got involved in history, you might say, because... all of a sudden, the Haig machine collapsed in 1949, just as I was getting out of college. And it was, for us, similar to the fall of Rome. I mean, you talk about barbarians at the gates, we had Republicans. And this was really quite a shock, though. And it really made me realize, for the first time, where I came from, how different we were from the rest of the country. We were really in a ghetto, an Irish Catholic ghetto there. And I had to learn about what it meant to be an American, an Irish American, you know, with the emphasis on the second part of the hyphen. And that's when I started studying American history. I really didn't know beans about the history of the country. I could tell you all about various aspects of the history of Ireland and the poetry of William Butler Yeats and stuff like that, but really didn't know much about America. And I got into writing that through this shock, I guess, shock treatment. And then I became really a specialist in the American Revolution, because I felt that was where you could really get at the roots of American character. And I wrote books on the Battle of Bunker Hill in Yorktown and biographies of Jefferson and Franklin. And then I also was writing novels about the Irish-American experience. My novel, All Good Men, was really a blow-by-blow of the collapse of the Haig machine in Jersey City. And then I slowly worked my way out of this, you might say, Irish-American ghetto from a fictional point of view, and started to blend the history and the fiction. And I first did that in the novel Liberty Tavern, which is set in the American Revolution in New Jersey, down on the Raritan River. And it did very, very well. It sold over 500,000 in paperback. And that was when I suddenly saw that this was what I could really do. I could take my history, my fascination with history, which I'd been using mostly in nonfiction, and put it together with my really, I think, talent for writing fiction. And tackle other aspects of America's past. So I did it with this book, The Officers' Wives, which I published in 81, and that was a very big success. It was on the bestseller list for quite a while and so forth. So I've been doing that ever since, I guess you'd say, trying to blend history and fiction and get at, in the fiction, aspects of the historical experience that aren't on the record. That's what fascinates me about writing historical novels. You can get into areas of the historical experience, particularly women's experience, that simply isn't there in black and white, and the historian, of course, has limited to the records. But you can infer, you can imagine, and so gradually I began to think that I picked this phrase up from a critic, but that I want to write, and I'm trying to write, novels of what I call novels of the historical imagination, where history and imagination are blended into a unique thing, I hope.
Well, let's go back. Where did you go to college?
I went to Fordham here in New York.
And you studied?
I never took a history course. I like to say that I educated myself at the public expense by writing history books, really. I was an English major, but I read a great deal of history. I remember I kept a record of how many history books I read in 1 year at Fordham. That was, I think, was my junior year, and it was well over 200 that I read on the side. So I've always had this real fascination for history, but I'm self-educated. I came at it originally sort of like Bruce Catton came at the Civil War. I came at the Revolution that way. And as a reporter, I'd been a newspaper reporter, and then I'd been a magazine editor and magazine article writer. And so I came at it that way. But then I got more and more interested, I think this is the fictional side, in the spiritual and psychological and philosophical dimensions of history as the more I worked in it. And that's where I turned then to writing biographies of Jefferson and Franklin, whom I think are the two truly seminal figures in American history.
Well, when you graduated from college, did you go into the Navy right away?
I was in the Navy at the very end of World War II. Mm-hmm. I joined up lest the war end without me getting in it. I rushed and joined up in spring of 1945, but I never... I'm not complaining about this, I should add. I never had a shot fired at me in anger. I was in boot camp when they dropped the atomic bomb. And I was probably the most relieved sailor in the Navy because I had just been assigned to the amphibious corps. And I was going to be at maybe the first wave of the invasion of Japan. So there wasn't too much of the kind of agonizing and mind-troubling questions raised at that time when I was 17 years old. That I raise in Time and Tide.
Well, your writing about what happens on this ship is so vivid that I could have sworn you must have been in the kind of combat that these men went through.
Well, I was on. Then I went from there to a light cruiser, and I spent a year on this light cruiser in the Pacific. We traveled all around in the 7th Fleet in peacetime, you know. But I was out there. The peacetime Navy shoots the guns off almost as much as the wartime Navy. In fact, I'll never forget one time we were in Tokyo Harbor, and it was the most rotten weather you've ever seen in your life. Fog and God knows what. And we suddenly, the whole fleet upped anchor and roared out to sea. This was towards the end of December. And we roared out to sea, and we proceeded to have gunnery practice. You couldn't see anything. We were firing on radar. And one shell from one of our sister cruisers came right between the stacks of our ship. And when you're firing on practice firing like that, you use offset firing, they call it. They set the range finders just a little bit off so that the shells fall, you know, 200 yards behind the target, the ship that you're shooting at, which happens to be an American ship. But it's counted as a hit, you know, and so forth. But this was a wild shell. And so, naturally, we got a little exercise. We came within an ace of getting blown apart. I was right up on deck when this thing came through, about 50 yards above my head. And so we later in the day, we said to one of our officers, what the hell are we doing out here, you know? He said, well, it's the end of the fiscal year. We got to fire off all this ammunition before the budget runs out.
You know, that's, but even in non-combat situations, it's dangerous in the military. I mean, you're dealing with explosives. I mean, you hear about it all the time.
It's a dangerous business, no question about it. You're sitting on all this explosives, as you say, and fuel oil, and, you know, it's a warship is a floating bomb in many respects. And to go back to what we were saying about combat and all that, all of the guys that were on the ship with me, I would say, maybe 75 or 80% of them had been in combat. The ship had been out there during the war. And so I sat around listening to their sea stories, as we call them in the Navy, which may have been a little more vivid than they actually were, I'll admit that. But I really did get a very good picture of what the war was like. And as I say, I was shooting off the guns myself, so I got a very good feel for what it was like to be on a combat ship.
God, only 17, too.
Yes, I was...
What happened when you got out of the Navy?
Well, then I went to Fordham and came out of Fordham and got a job on a newspaper, the Yonkers Herald Statesman, and then went to magazines. I worked for the Reader's Digest and then to Cosmopolitan. I always like to say before Helen Gurley Brown got there. Not that I'm against what Helen is doing to my old magazine, but it's different, I'll say that. And
a lot more sex in it.
Yes. Let's put it mildly. And then I started to write at the same time.
Which was your first book?
My first book was called Now We Are Enemies, The Battle of Bunker Hill. I wrote that while I was a magazine editor at Cosmopolitan. And it did extremely well. It was a book club selection and so forth. And that got me into, I guess you might say, the history writing game. Because naturally, the editors then asked me to write more books on American history, which I did. The Battles of Yorktown. And I did a very, very big, I call it my attempt at a masterwork, I guess you'd say, on the American Revolution, my summation of the American Revolution, which is called 1776 Year of Illusions, which really does try to sum up all of my thinking about the Revolution, not just describing battles, but also the philosophy on both sides, the illusions particularly. That's the major insight of the book, is that both sides didn't have a clue as to what they were really doing during the year 1776. They both made horrendous mistakes, and they both were laboring under massive illusions about what the war was, how the war was going to go, and what it was really about in many ways.
Well, history certainly can be dramatic, but the historian is confined to the facts.
Exactly.
And
yes.
To a degree, he's confined to what he knows about dialogue and...
He can't use very much dialogue.
Right.
As a matter of fact, in Now We Are Enemies, I was very honest about it. I said in my notes that a few points I used dialogue that I thought was perfectly plausible. Like, for instance, when Colonel Prescott is up there on Bunker Hill, and the British start shelling him, and one of the first shells comes over and decapitates a man on the parapet, and his bloody corpse falls on the ground, and everybody panics. And this was the whole American army was within one inch of running away. And Prescott just got that corpse out of it. He took charge and said, and I put in the dialogue, I said, get rid of that man. Bury him immediately, I forget, or something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was. But I added that dialogue, which was not in the record, but I put it in my footnotes, of course. Well, although the book, as I say, did very well, I was severely censured by some historians who said, you just don't do this, and so forth. And I never did again.
These are the academic historians.
Yes, particularly academic historians.
But Thomas Fleming, as a fiction writer who is dealing with history, and Time and Tide, of course, is a historical drama.
Yes.
But you can tell history in a much more vivid way by being a fiction writer.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I think so. You get down into the emotional reactions of people who are, as I like to say, on the cutting edge of history, who are right there involved in it, and at all levels. I mean, there are records, usually, of the men on at the top, you know, generals, admirals write their memoirs, and they recollect what they said, which probably wasn't at all what they actually said in battles and so forth, and they can discuss the strategy and what have you. But the average soldier or sailor is not, there are very, very few records, in fact, practically none, of him. And we also know that they, even the ones that exist, are notoriously unreliable. SLA Marshall, the General Marshall, who was famous General Marshall, but SLA, Slam Marshall, I guess he was called, who wrote a number of wonderful books about combat and so forth. He was the one who created the dictum, I guess is the correct word, that if you don't get to a man within 4 hours after he comes out of combat, don't bother, because he cannot, after that he begins to recreate what actually happened. It's so terrifying and so terrible. Well, how many men are gotten to 4 hours after they got out of combat? Extremely few. So there is where I think the historical novelist who has been in combat or understands what it means to be in combat by talking to people who have been in it, and incidentally I didn't just rely on my experience when I was 17 years old for this Time and Tide. I went all over the country to ship reunions and talked to veterans of the war out there, officers and men. And I went to Annapolis and talked to retired admirals and captains down there to get their feelings as they recollected them. So a novelist who has done that kind of homework can really using the key phrase, the key word, plausibility, if he really knows his history and has a good imagination, he can recreate, I think, the situation as it really happened, or pretty close to it anyway.
Well, one thing I can say about Time and Tide is it's harrowing. It just doesn't let up, except for Shore Leave occasionally and reunions with wives and girlfriends,
yes,
and lovers. But it's essentially... it's harrowing, and everybody dies, and that raft trip at the end, you know.
Yes.
And it's horrifying, and I would assume very, very accurate.
Yes. The USS Jefferson City is what I call in a prism, like a capsule of the historical imagination. It absorbs the identities of several, or maybe a half dozen ships, whom I studied in the course of the war. And as it moves through the war, it does some of the things these ships experiences some of the things these ships experienced. And so it's all, I think, very authentic. And I particularly think when you say harrowing, I'm really rather flattered, because it brings out a part of the war in the Pacific, the Navy War in the Pacific, that I don't think the American public has at all realized. We've been given mostly the victories. We've been told about Midway, particularly. We've had that coming out our ears. Of course, we know about Pearl Harbor, which was like a shock or disaster or so forth, but it was over so quickly. But we've heard about Midway. We've heard about Coral Sea, the big victories. But we haven't really, there have been very, very few novels about the long, bitter campaign for Guadalcanal, and then the night battles and so forth. I mean, I was absolutely enthralled by digging out from after-action reports and so forth. I got microfilms from the Navy. You know, each ship writes an after-action report, and they're on microfilm, and I got these and read them. And it's just, you know, it makes your hair stand on end to imagine what these guys were going through, taking on these Japanese battleships in the dark, just these 14-inch shells rumbling out of the night to splash all around you, and every second you're within 1 inch of oblivion. I mean, that's really, something that Americans have forgotten, you know, that the Navy went through this sort of thing.
Well, it also, in reading Time and Tide, it also, it's so shocking that it really makes you think about the horror of war.
Well, I think it did. I wanted people to do that. I think that it's not a pro-war book by any means, but I think it is. I guess one reviewer said, "Tom Fleming obviously loves the Navy, but he loves it so much he wants to show it to you warts and all." And I think that's what I've tried to do in this book. I've tried to show some of the dark sides of life on a ship, but on the other hand, I really tried to show what these guys endured and what they achieved, too.
Oh, yes, there's no doubt that you did show the heroism of many of these men, but you also showed a great deal of ignorance among the people in the Navy, incompetence.
Yes.
I was shocked, but I guess I shouldn't have been shocked, because why should the people in the Navy or on a given ship be any different than any other cross-section of humanity?
That's exactly right. The ship is, in a way, USS Jefferson City is a symbol of America as well as of a Navy ship. And it is a cross-section. And I think, too, that a friend of mine, a very good historian named Trumbull Higgins, you say mentioned incompetence and so forth, he said something to me very amusing the other day. He said, he was talking about, I think it was World War II, but anyway, the point was, he said, why, it got to the point in that war where the politicians actually started promoting the right people. They started putting really talented admirals and generals in charge of things. He said, that's very unusual, Tom, you know that. And I said, yeah, I agree with you, Trumbull, it is unusual. And then, like all big organizations, in the beginning of a war, the Navy has got a lot of people at the top who are there because they're good politicians, they have a lot of friends in powerful places, and so forth and so forth. But usually, and the United States has been very lucky in this respect, the war shakes everybody down. And everybody realizes this is for real, and these guys, the Japanese, in our case, were really good, and they were tough. They were terrific sailors and terrific pilots, and they couldn't afford to have anybody out there in command who wasn't the best. But it took a while to find out what was wrong with the people they had out there in the beginning.
The enlisted men that you portray, so many of them were so brutal.
Well, they were tough characters. You're thinking of the old Navy guys. I mean, I think the new draftees, or enlistees like myself, were not that way. But, I mean, the old Navy guys were tough characters. They really were. I mean, the one guy in the book who's actually my favorite character in the whole novel, Bosun Homewood, he's a real character. He's the only name I didn't change in the whole book. He was my bosun's mate on the USS Topeka, and I love the guy. He was just fantastic, and he was just like he is in the book, as tough as can be. He built like 5 feet across, you know, and about the 6 feet high, and he just arms on him like he could bend one of the barrels of the 6-inch guns if he felt like it. And, you know, when he went ashore, I mean, they needed 16 shore patrolmen to get him back on the ship.
But then you had, I believe his name is Wilkerson.
Oh, yes, he was a bad boss.
Yeah.
Right, yes. Well, he was also a real character on my ship, not by that name, I should add. But he was a man who used to say on my ship, on the beach I got the pretty girls, at sea I got the pretty boys. And he got them, too.
That strikes me as unusual. It seems to me, especially in the 1940s, a taint of homosexuality would be almost fatal on board a ship.
Well, the Navy took very severe steps any time they ever had an outbreak. They just got them off the ships. That's all there was to it. I mean, they it was a very severe offense and so forth. But actually, homosexuality on board ships is as old as the Phoenicians, as one of the officers on the Jefferson City says. After all, sailors are away from land for an awfully long time, and it's hinted at, for instance, in some of Melville's books, and it isn't uncommon by any means. And the Navy was in World War II. The Navy had a special intelligence division which did nothing but work on this homosexuality problem. And one retired admiral told me that he was captain of a destroyer, and this one of these special intelligence guys came on his ship and told him that he had an ensign who was a homosexual. He was picking up young boys on the beach. You know, he wasn't doing anything on the ship. And this man was the captain of the ship at the time. He's a commander. And I said, well, I think you should prefer charges. And so he wanted to the usual Navy procedure. You know, you don't just derrick somebody off a ship and so forth. And the guy said, if you want your career in the Navy to go forward, you will allow us to take this man off the ship without any further argument. See, because a captain in the Navy is supposed to defend his men against all comers. I mean, that's part of being a shipmate, part of being part of this special community that is a ship. And but in this case, this captain, he was, you know, looking back on it and sort of regretting it. But he said, well, if you put it that way, okay, take him. And they took him, and he was they court-martialed him on the beach somewhere, and got rid of him.
Now, after the Jefferson City was torpedoed, and these survivors are in the rafts.
Yes.
Was there a parallel to this?
Yes. This is the USS Indianapolis, and this was the final ship that the Jefferson City's identity absorbed. The USS Indianapolis carried the atomic bomb to Tinian, where they then put it on a plane and dropped it on Japan. And while the Indianapolis was on its way to the Philippines from what went to Guam, and then it went on to it was on its way to the Philippines, a few days later it was torpedoed by probably the last Japanese submarine still at sea, and there was no signal sent. The ship went down so fast, and people in the Philippines the whole thing was just a terrible screw up. They didn't notice that it hadn't arrived. Somebody from Guam didn't send them the information that the ship was en route. There was all sorts of routine procedures that were not followed, and the men were in the water for 3 or 4 days, and almost half of, well over half, actually, of the men that got off the ship died in the water, and it was just a horrible, horrible experience, and a terrible shadow, you might say, on our victory. And to me also, as I hint in Time and Tide, it raised a question in my mind about very, very large questions about the role of the U.S. in American history. Was this the captain of the Jefferson City thinks, was this a sign from some spiritual power telling us that this maybe dropping this atomic bomb was not the thing we should have done. But I don't try to resolve that question. It's just, again, the novelist is dealing with plausibility, not with the actual historical record. This is something I believe my captain at Jefferson City, a man with a very sensitive conscience and a humane man, I think that's what he would have thought as the waters closed around him and his ship was going down. He was opposed to he didn't like the idea of dropping the bomb. He found out about it on the way out. And I know for a fact that from historical research that many of the top admirals in the Navy were not happy with that for a number of reasons. In the book, for instance, I use Admiral Spruance as the spokesman, you might say, for those people. And I have him say, my captain visits him the night he saw the tests from New Mexico, the Alamogordo tests. And they had flown them out to Tinian and then showed them to Spruance, who was on Saipan, the next island over. And in my novel, Spruance says to Captain McKay, "I think it's monstrous. I'd rather lose 600 ships than drop it." And his chief of staff says, "You can't say that in public, Admiral." And he says, "Of course I know I can't say it in public." Now, Walter Lord in the New York Times raised great issue with me. He reviewed my book in the New York Times. He raised great issue with me. He said I was muddying the historical record because I put those words in Spruance's mouth, and he got out Spruance's autobiography, where Spruance is quoted as saying that he was, in a sense, relieved that the bomb was dropped because he didn't have to worry about losing 600 ships. Now, he said this about 2 weeks after the bomb was dropped. Now, I, the historical novelist, dealing, as I have tried to demonstrate, in plausibility, I think, knowing Spruance, and I did study his character very intensely and talked about him to a number of people who knew him, I think that it's very plausible that this man would have said that at this time.
Well, you can't muddy the historical waters in fiction.
Well, that's what I think, too. I mean, I thought Walter...
Have you say anything you want him to say.
Walter is a good friend of mine, but I really think that he misunderstood what a novelist is doing compared to what a nonfiction writer is doing, which is, of course, what he is, and a very good one.
Yes, I think he may have read this book and felt it so intentionally that it was true and accurate.
Maybe that's a compliment. I know he said a lot of very wonderful things about the book in his review, so I don't mean to take out against him or anything, but I do disagree with that one point.
Well, it seems to me that especially at times of war, he's so vulnerable on a ship. Like, you know, Reagan has these ships over in the Persian Gulf.
Yes, yes.
And we're already, we've had that one ship that was hit by
the Stark, yes.
The Stark was hit,
yes.
And all those men died and all that. It just seems to me you're trapped.
Oh, absolutely. You definitely have that feeling. That's why there's such intense sense of the idea of a shipmate is very, very powerful in the Navy. If you see a shipmate in trouble, you know, getting beaten up by a couple of Marines on the beach or something like that, you just go help him. That's all there is to it. Because this guy is part of this it's not necessarily a small group. There were 1,300 men on a cruiser like the Jefferson City or my own cruiser. But still, they're all part of this entity that you are living inside, you know. And you don't say it. You never say, "I was on it." You say, "I was on her." A ship has a person, you know. It's a she, and you always talk about her in that way. She's like your mother in a way, you know. And so there is this very strong family sense, and even perhaps even deeper than family. And you hear it, you know, say, "Oh yes, I'd do anything for that guy. We were shipmates once." The old Navy guys would say this again and again. You know?
Well, Thomas Fleming, "Tide and Time and Tide" is a wonderful book, and
thank you.
People aren't convinced about how horrible war is. They will be after they finish reading your book. And are you going to? My last question, I guess, would be: are you going to continue to develop historical fiction, or do you ever plan to go back to the straight history?
Well, I have been for many years doing research on a book about the Burr-Hamilton duel, which I have.
Gore Vidal did that already.
Well, he did.
It was called Burr.
I can do it better. I can tell the truth. now I'm giving the historical novelist the business as a historian. See, that's how crooked you can play the game. But No, but I, for the time being, though, I do plan to continue to write historical fiction. I just finished a very interesting novel about the IRA and the Irish Americans, and I'm now starting work on a novel about World War One, which has always intrigued me because my father was in it, and I grew up listening to my father tell me World War One stories.
Gosh, the writing process never stops, does it?
I hope not.
You work out of your home?
Yes, I
you
do, yeah.
A little private place? You're not...
Yes, now that the children have moved out, I've commandeered what was a bedroom. And I used to work in my bedroom, though, like many a New York writer. And then now I've got my own study, which makes me feel like a king almost.
Yeah, this is a long book. Did you use a word processor?
Yes, I did, yes.
What do you use?
I use an Adler word processor.
An Adler?
Yes, it's a kind of a special one. It's an Adler typewriter, electronic typewriter, which is hooked into a word processing setup. So the word processor, the printer, is the typewriter, and you type on the typewriter keys, and it shows up on a screen. It works very well. It's a dedicated word processor.
But you can shift copy, save copy.
Oh yeah, you can do everything that you can do with any other word processor.
That must be really a time saver when you're dealing with a book as big as yours.
Oh, it's immense time saver, and especially for revisions. I mean, I revised this book 5 times in total, but I also in between. That's the wonderful thing about a word processor. You can go back and revise it. Part of a chapter so quickly, you know.
I was talking to T. Kragerson Boyle today,
yes.
And this is also a rather long book.
Yes.
And when he finished his first draft, he wrote his second draft on a Smith Corona manual typewriter. It took him 6 weeks just to type it.
My God, I admire a man who does that.
But, he said he wanted to do it. He said he felt closer to the book and he could make some minor changes.
I do know writers who have done that, yes, yeah. Yes. But I've gotten into word processing and I'm in love with it.
Well, you're going to turn out more books than T. Kragerson Boyle, too.
Oh, maybe. I hope so. Anyway,
well, it's really been fun talking to you.
Well, same here.
Interesting guy, and it's a great book, and thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Don.